Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
Hi, I'm Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
All right, here we go.
Okay, good
interview. We are live in 3, 2, 1.
Okay, here we go. Welcome to West Point, Mississippi, guys, home of Mossy Oak. David Hawley sitting in Lanny's chair. Lanny's on vacation. Look at Davis.
Big chair to fill for a little man like myself.
Right. Dudley, looking at you, you look like you're ready for turkey season.
I am. It is turkey season.
I like that shirt you got on. You look good.
Yeah. It's my favorite color.
We've got companions all around the table now.
Yeah, and then Richie's on the board. Richie, you don't hit the horns for yourself now. And we've got – Richie's going to be gone next week, so I'm worried.
You know about Richie's going to be button happy if he's going to take a week off, so watch
it. Well, I'm not taking a week off. I got to go down to Florida, too, and go film our buddy there, Jason McKiller, and his kids down there.
Throw you in the briar patch.
Uh-huh. That's right.
So –
and then when I look over here to our right, through the magic of the internet, we have one of our favorite doctors, Dr. Mike Chamberlain.
Yeah, get the horn. I can, you know what? The I'm good looking doctor. At the glow, the rosy glow on your face, and I'm guessing bill fishing in the Caribbean. No. Snow skiing in the, Colorado. No. I'm thinking prescribed fire got too close to you.
Yes.
Yeah. He is red as a tomato.
He is.
Well, part of that's an illusion. It's the glow from my laptop because there's no other lighting in this room except for this window. So it creates this illusion that I'm.
Who needs a tanning bed anymore? Go prescribe burn.
You look like
I'm
somebody.
Not as burnt as I look, but yeah, I am a bit red. Yeah,
you are very red.
Yep.
That's
my way to get a tan right there.
Yeah.
Well, so you were burning yesterday?
We were. Yeah, we had about 75 acres of upland pine that we wanted to get done before this rain that set in this morning. So yesterday was a long day, but we got it done. And we had, like we talked about before we started taping, the few, burning conditions were ideal here yesterday. Once the humidity dropped late morning, it was one of those afternoons where, you get complete fuel consumption and the fire behaves and isn't, right. Doesn't cause you concern, and it was one of those good burn days where you get a lot accomplished.
How many steps did you say were on your phone?
27,000.
27,000.
That should be, and on top of the improved complexion and the suntan and all, you get a cardio workout too.
Absolutely.
Right. I don't. Yeah, you can't get one of those on a walking machine or something. No, sir.
Improved complexion.
27,000.
That's a lot of steps. Have you ever taken 27,000 steps, David?
That's a lot of steps for me.
David would have been doing that like if he went with Neil somewhere.
Yeah.
Hunting. And they cover 10 miles.
27,000 steps for David. That's
a lot of steps.
Yeah.
A lot of steps. Yeah.
So what is that? So is it 5,000 equals a mile? Is that about right?
Depends on your step. Bobby?
I think with mine, I walk. About 4 or 5 times a week. And I usually do 5,200 to 6,200 steps. And that ends up being, I'm long legged. So that's right under 2 miles for me.
Yeah. So, he is long. He's kind of like a Jake. He's got those long legs, real tall, kind of gangly looking.
Man. I would still say he's a long beard, Bobby.
Yeah.
He's got a longer beard than I do.
Jake here,
I've got this little Jake beard thing. He's a limb hanger.
He does have a long beard. Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, we're happy to have you.
What are we talking? complexion and everything for. Let's move on.
Well, you are. You got a rosy red. I was just trying to point out all the attributes of controlled burning to the public out there. It's more than just improving your wildlife habitat.
Oh, for sure.
You know, it is.
It's a cardio workout. It is. It's a suntan.
Honestly, yeah. I'm so spent the day we hit them hard that I sleep so much better and I feel so much better next time. I'm just sore. But it's a great workout.
That's what I told them when we started. I woke up this morning and I was like, oh, wow. That, you know, and I walk a lot, but I mean, you're walking on uneven ground and you're carrying that trip torch in your hand the entire time. And let's admit it, we're all a little nervous, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you're igniting the landscape. You're taking responsibility for something that can go awry. And maybe nobody else gets nervous, but I get nervous. I get my heart rate's up. I'm hyper vigilant. I'm trying to pay attention to what's going on and not make mistakes. So it just wears you out. But to your point, Toxie, it's such a good tired.
Oh,
when you wake up, you sleep so well.
Yeah, I think it's healthy to be a little bit paranoid when you're lighting a fire, you know?
It's like I've been asked so many times, how do you never have an accident or something? Well, that's like sooner or later, everybody's going to have something. And the key is be prepared for every single possibility. Mm-hmm. You know, you said the magic word when you're talking about, you know, something might could get away or, you said the word dozer. Well, if you got the equipment and you're prepared, you know, and you keep an eye on it. But anyway, it's Mother Nature. He's right. Anything could happen. So you just stay on your toes.
All right, guys. So let's look at turning the page here. And one of the things, Mike's good at a lot of stuff. He's fascinating. But
Bobby's wanting you to take him hunting.
There ain't no doubt about that. So every Tuesday, Mike has this thing called Turkey Tuesday. And it's so good. Anybody that's interested in turkeys can learn something.
Yeah, I've got notifications set up. So when it hits, I know to go check it.
Yeah. So he's got an Instagram page. Probably a lot of people listen to this already. David, I'm sure you do. The Wild Turkey Doc. And on Instagram, at Wild Turkey Doc. But Mike, can you tell us a little bit about what you're trying to accomplish with this?
Yeah. Yeah. So this post started about 2018-ish, something about that time frame. And originally it was twofold. One, I was trying to come up with a way to make people think about turkeys outside of just turkey season. And that was kind of secondary. The primary thing was I was seeing, you know, social media had gotten very popular then, and there were a lot of people posting content on social media that was misinformation about turkeys and their management. And I was seeing agencies post information about topics such as prescribed burning or predators, or you pick a topic that's contentious with people. And I was seeing a lot of comments that were just misinformation. And I thought, I know that biologist that just posted that, and I know he can't respond to that post, or I know she can't engage with this person, but I can. So what if I started posting once a week or every so often? Originally, I thought, and just throw a little bit of science out, just a little something, like a little nugget about fire or a little nugget about this. And maybe people will read it and appreciate it. And it started out very slowly, but eventually it caught on. I was fortunate enough to be on some podcasts, including yours, and people started seeing the information. And then I realized that a sexy picture helps a lot, and that I kind of honed in on the type of content that I think resonates with people, whether it's something they enjoy reading or it's something that causes a reaction, whether it's a controversial topic or not. And so it's just kind of morphed from there. It's become something I didn't think it would become. It was never my intention to have this thing that shows up every week. It just kind of became that. And as it grew, I realized that people were paying attention to it, and they were using the content to kind of refine their thinking and to inform other people. And so from the start, I've tried to focus on science, on information that is that's published, that's available, that things that we know about turkeys. And in some cases, I've focused on some things we don't know, but are really interesting, I think. And yeah, it's just, it's progressed through time to become this thing that it is. And it's very humbling to see how it's, you know, how it's aged, if you will.
Yeah. It's so well done, David. You do the Wild Turkey Report.
That's his baby.
And it's just some good information that comes out.
You know, for all the disdain that a lot of people have for social media, I think it's been a powerful vector for sharing this type of information and building awareness that we didn't have this vehicle 10 or 15 years ago. And so I know, Mike, you've probably seen from your corner people that used to only care about the pull of the trigger that now are doing things to help and give back to the wild turkey. And a lot of that happened from, you know, this awareness has been brought around from things like Turkey Tuesday.
I bet you can feel the topic kind of resonate with people. You probably get feedback pretty quick, I would imagine, Mike.
Yeah, and I try to, believe it or not, I don't really plan these things out. Sometimes I'm literally coming up with a topic Sunday night, and in other times I have a plan a week or two or maybe more in advance. And I try to sprinkle in content that I think will just be interesting to somebody, like how does a turkey's hearing work, or what's their, you know, how do they see the world from a vision standpoint, or, you know, how many feathers do they have and how are they arranged, you know, very, very kind of biological kind of that type of content. And then sometimes I'll post something about their behavior and what we've learned through some of the technology we have and what it's showing us about how complex they are. And then sometimes I'll take the bull by the horns and I'll post something that I know is going to get me some backlash because it may be a topic that's more controversial and polarizing, if you will. You know, like fire, for instance. Fire is always one that is very polarizing, and I'm willing to have that conversation because I think it's important that we be able to see information and challenge it if we're interested in doing that. You know, if you read something and you want more information, or you have a disagreement with it, or you want to question it, you want more information, then I'm okay with people doing that. And so to your question, yeah, I try to think through the ideas and to be honest with you, sometimes I've been really blessed because I have some very talented photographers, some of which you've talked with, who send me pictures, and those pictures stimulate me. They cause me intellectual curiosity, you know, like, how did you get that shot? What is that bird doing? Like, what's the story here? The picture will kind of stimulate that would make a really cool post about whatever it is. So sometimes just getting the pictures from folks who are willing to share them stimulates the post for that week.
So I got to say, one of the things I think that has helped so much in a lot of stuff, but you're so good. I mean, especially with your calling. I mean, you're almost always based on truth and kind of like proven truth, vetted truth, not just, you know, one or two times. And so what I'm getting at is, having grown up completely in and around turkey hunting for, I guess I looked up the other day, 55 years maybe, and seeing from that far back to today, so much of what was presented as fact was actually indeed maybe fiction. and all the different, you know, theories of why they do this, why they do that, what's good for them, what raises them, what, you know, how do you, what happens to poults or nests, or, I mean, just the myriad of questions that we all marvel at trying to answer today. And so it was just, it's just a dangerous thing to see. And it's also on social media to take opinion and try to insert your ego and make it fact. And that's when bad things happen to all of us. But especially we're dealing, when it's not just me and Bobby having an argument, or me and you, we're dealing with wildlife and what's best for them. So it's just so refreshing when you can take a stand. And I quite honestly, I feel like we've had made a big difference. And in your world, I think you've made a tremendous difference being a little bit of a pioneer. It sounds like you were almost stepping as a, you know, fending off some cyber bullying almost at first, you know, with some of that. But, you know,
that's true.
When, yeah, you know, but when you're steeped in fact and the research, and, you know, it helps us a lot too, when you're trying to just get the stuff out to people, you're with a, such a great university. And so are a lot of your counterparts. And so collectively, I mean, that's just the wisdom we have. And I just think it makes such a big difference now, just like what we're jointly helping you with the lab, you know, for people to go to. So in your dream, and we are right there with you, it's like average everybody doesn't have to, you know, necessarily be plugged into everything we're doing or be a biologist to be able to access and understand these truths that you have vetted and your counterparts in the last, whatever, 10, yeah, 20, 30 years. It's so good for what we're doing. It's, yeah, just amazing.
And, you know, we were hitting on social media earlier, but it just makes it so much easier to access that information compared to having to dig up a university publication off of a university website. That's, yeah, just not and, how most and part of us of,
and
take
part
it
of what
in.
I'm trying to do is to, you know, take information that Dudley's never going to go find in some ways, because he'll never be able to find it. It's hidden somewhere in some, you know, journal article written in 1986.
Right. That, and a lot of that stuff, you have to be a student at the university to even have access to it, unless you're paying for that service. You know?
Right. And so in some ways I'm trying to put information out there that I know people are otherwise not going to get. And the other thing, that's, this isn't something interesting, you know, I've had this conversation with other people, but these posts really became popular during COVID. Mm-hmm. And that's when we were stuck and we couldn't interact with each other and we were starving for information and turkey hunting was on our mind. And we had all of this stuff, this noise going on in our world. And we were so fearful and there was so much misinformation. And I can distinctly remember my life then and what it looked like. And we wanted to talk to each other. And one form of talking to each other was to look at social media and engage with each other. And that's when these posts took off, is when people started looking for a way to engage and to get information. And, you know, there's not a lot of positive that came out of that pandemic, but from a communication standpoint, that is one thing that it is positive that came out of it. People started seeking information through social media. Somebody told me the other day, they said, you know, I was on a phone call with this person and he said, I would have never thought in my life that science would have been sexy. That, you know, and this is a turkey person. He said, I would have never thought that turkey science would be something that would attract people's attention. And it's funny that it is. And it's so wonderful to see it. Now part of the reason is because we're concerned about the declining populations that we have in some areas, but his point is valid. And I agree with it, that it's refreshing to see people care enough to seek out the information and obtain it. That's a positive.
So, go ahead, Tom.
I just think, you know, turkey, I'm looking around the room and David, especially his dad, Chris, Bobby, Dudley, we, and myself for sure. I mean, as a group, as a family, whatever, turkey hunters, we want to know, we want to be not, you know, you have a little pride in like understanding what goes. I think more than any, I'm looking around at all different types of hunting, whether coon hunting, rabbit hunting, everything, squirrel hunting, deer hunting, elk hunting. I mean, I just think turkey hunters are more interested in being knowledgeable about all of this stuff and always have. And now that thirst has been there, but now someone's quenching it with fact. And it's like, it's one thing I tell you, I see it all the time. And I mean, just like you see people that love sports and they love to know more about the draft this year than their buddy knows about the draft and all this stuff. But when you go to camp or you're around people and they start throwing out these opinions as fact and you squelch it with fact, like from research or from listening to you or somebody, it's kind of fun, I have to say, you know, and honestly, we feel smart. So there's nothing wrong with that. And it's for the betterment of the bird. But, you know, I just think turkey hunters really want to know, honestly.
Oh, I mean, you know, I went to school a little bit for some of this stuff. But, I mean, you know, I have friends that are, you know, lawyers or welders or whatever. And they know a lot about, you know, turkey biology, deer. We used to just like to hunt and eat the meat. But now we want to know why about everything and how to make it better.
Well, go ahead. But, Doc, I just got to say, too, it's so refreshing on top of that, too, that it has spawned. And I think the turkey hunting guy, maybe more than anybody, and deer's pretty close. But what I'm getting at is, like, they understand now in the last 5 to 10 years, maybe longer, that, you know, you can take matters in your own hands. You don't have to leave it to someone else to make a bunch of mistakes and mess it up. You can take the things that matter as you learn more in your own hands. We're talking about a lot of it today. And so that has become a sport, just like hunting turkeys has become a sport. And we call it being a gamekeeper. And I just love that that has taken on more and more and more, because the net is people are enjoying life more. They're having more abundance of wildlife. And as a collective, we're helping the bird rebound and get where he needs to.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I'll give you the last word on this, and then I'm going to start asking you some questions.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and we can get back to this. I was just going to say one thing that's come out of these Tuesday posts that I find really interesting is that, you know, you get questions like, well, what about, you pick a topic and or question, and I'll answer the person through a comment. Well, we don't really know. We're studying that now. We're trying to understand that. And what I've realized is that there's a general lack of understanding about kind of how people like me do science. And what I mean by that, I'm not criticizing. I'm simply saying that, you know, it takes a while to do the studies that I articulate to people that were done back in, you know, the 60s or the 80s or the 2000s. It doesn't matter. The common theme with published research is that it took time. It took developing a question. It took getting money. It took conducting the field research, analyzing the data. And then that last step of publishing the data, that takes time. Sometimes just getting it published takes a year or more. And the peer review process where I take my science and other people judge it, that takes time. And so you want these quick answers to people's questions, but science doesn't work like that in a lot of ways. So the reason I'm pointing this out is what it's caused me to do is to go back in the literature of this bird, anticipating questions that I'm going to get about these topics. And it's caused me to very, very closely evaluate work dating back into the 1930s, because I want to be able to answer people's questions. And if I can't, I want to be able to speak intelligently about whatever this topic is. And it's forced me to become a better student of the bird and the science, because I've had to go back and read materials that were foundational to where I am now. And that I see real value in that. And I also am starting to see real value in other people realizing that stuff is out there. That when somebody contacts me and says, hey, where did you mention something in this post about iridescence? I'm just picking a topic. Where did you get that? Oh, well, that's from two published articles back in the 1990s. Shoot me an email and I'll send them to you, type of thing. And what I've realized is that, many of those people will then subsequently contact me again and say, holy cow, that is so cool. Like, I just read that article that was published that you mentioned. That is really interesting. I would have never seen that 5 years ago. That I gave presentation after presentation after presentation and never engaged in that way that I can engage with a single post on Tuesdays. It's just, it's remarkable. To David's point, where social media has gone.
Well, you do a great job with it, and we're real proud of you for it. And so, look, I want to turn the page. I don't know how scientific my question is, but maybe it'll open the door and we can go somewhere. And I expect you'll have a scientific answer. But we all, and I look around the room, we all experience from time to time, I think everybody does, I'll just call them an evil turkey that we have a hard time killing. And for whatever reason, I've always heard that he might, potentially a bird could keep other birds from gobbling. So you might have other birds on your property, but you only have one goblin, and it's because of this old bad evil turkey. Is there, scientifically, what can you help me understand about that? Is that just a wives' tale?
Well, I mean, socially, yes. I mean, a bird could socially make other birds in the population adjust their behavior because they, through their dominance hierarchies, don't want to deal with the wrath of, you know, inciting, I guess I'll use that term, a bird that's socially dominant over them. I've seen that many times myself, and I've also seen, just from a hunting perspective, situations where a bird gets removed and gobbling increases in that general area. And the scientific explanation is just that that's the dominance hierarchies at play. We're working on a paper about this topic. It's related to this topic. We're exploring these little pockets that these toms use. I just posted about this, I think, last week.
Yeah.
These little leks, right, where these toms go and display. And what turkeys do, which is interesting, is they can't see each other from these spots, right? So you got two places. Let's say Toxie's got two places on his property that toms end up and in the mornings, and they're strutting and they're gobbling there. And they can't see each other from those two spots. Those two groups of toms can't see each other, but they can hear each other if they gobble. And that's kind of how they maintain those dominance hierarchies. So, yes, I can easily see a scenario where you have one bird or one social group of toms that's keeping others at bay, if you will, because they're socially dominant in the hierarchy.
Doctor, I know you've experienced that. We've talked about it well.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no hard pack rules, but I have seen a couple of very dramatic instances that, you know, one got taken out and there was not anything but the one, and quite often he would, I mean, might gobble a lot on the roost, but then that was kind of it because he didn't have to. But then it had opened it up. More than my own experience was listening to some other people and a broader group of people that have had a lifetime of experience in it, and their opinions as to their facts kind of all differ. But some of the ones I think have had the most experience, without calling names about it, but they, I've always felt like to shoot the, you know, shoot the goblin, strutting turkey and open it up for the rest of them. Now, you know, when I was a kid, and this is, I'm sure he's going to talk about this today some too. When I was a kid, Daddy always told me, and it was just, you know, there was no research in his opinion, but his group would always say, hey, if more than one turkey comes up, and don't shoot the goblin turkey because you get to leave him to enjoy him again. Because, I mean, the whole point was to work a goblin turkey, not just to shoot one. And so they always would say, be sure and shoot the one that's not gobbling and leave the one that's gobbling, you know, to enjoy another day type of thing. So that's kind of polar opposite to my friends who've witnessed probably thousands of turkey hunts through their place over the many years that say, shoot the boss turkey because it helps open up So I don't know. I think it differs, and it's not a perfect science. But now we also know that if you shoot that boss too early in the season, you may hurt your reproduction, you know. So that's another thing to consider too.
Yeah. I think we've learned – I think the from the when we started to where we are now, there's probably a much better way to look at this.
So you know for the public, as so many people in this country now have – come to know my dad, Mr. Fox. You know what he always said, Mike, from the time I was just barely could go with him? He said, son, shoot the first bearded SOB you can get your bead on.
Yeah.
He said.
Sage wisdom there.
Yeah, he was like people talking about, oh, they came up and this one had a bigger beard and I was waiting and they got away from me. Or this one, I knew that one's one with the big spurs. He could care less. The first legal turkey that you can – get your gun beat on if that's what he believed in doing. You know?
So what does the science tell us that we ought to be doing there, Mike? Fair question, or am I catching
that's you? A tough one.
You mean with individual birds that walk up like that?
No, not necessarily with individual birds, but when if you've got multiple birds that walked up. I know we've asked you this question before, but that hadn't changed, has it?
And to Toxie's point, I mean, to be honest with you, if you're towards a certain stage in the breeding season where a lot of your breeding's already occurred, it doesn't matter. I mean, it very likely doesn't matter which bird in that group you shoot. Just to Toxie's point, shoot the one you can. What the research has shown is that, you know, really, it's more problematic. You're really only concerned with two things from a population perspective: is the rate and timing of harvest. So, if you're killing a percentage that's appropriate for the population, like we've talked about on other podcasts, then it's fine. And if the timing of the harvest makes sense biologically, then at an individual decision making scenario like what you're asking. Does it matter? Probably not. If you're shooting the right percentage and you're taking them at the right times, then I kind of agree with Mr. Fox. take the bird you can take. Type of thing.
Yeah. I think the thing that has come to light that you've helped bring to light the last couple of years that's really is just that one bird. And if you can, and I mean, people need to go hunting, and there's a lot of fun and joy in killing a really old, tough turkey. You know, you talked about one of your friends calling one away from hens is special. But in general, that's a headwind if you take him out too soon, right? You know, with the early season stuff. Yeah, so doesn't mean it's the end of the world. But in general, just like harvesting deer in certain, disciplines, in general, that'd be the best one to leave early in the season, right?
And we are seeing that we are learning – these toms, they don't all behave the same. We're seeing that pretty clearly.
Yes.
Bobby, I don't know if there's something you want me to go down this rabbit hole, but we actually, every turkey hunter knows, obviously, right? You all interact with birds, and some of them behave a certain way and some behave a different way. And we see that with toms. When we look at their behaviors, we see that there's just a ton of individual variation. There's not really a lot of averages out there. And so what we've started doing, which is not common in the turkey world as of yet, but it is very common in other in folks that study other species, is we've started trying to assign personalities to toms. And I'll explain what that means. Basically, there's a whole discipline in wildlife research that looks at personalities of birds. And to do that, you look at how all your sample of animals behaves, and then you assign them to different personalities, such as he moves more, he has a larger home range, he hangs out near roads. I'm giving you just scenarios here. He's a risky guy. He's a risk taker. This guy hangs out way away from roads, doesn't move much. When he does move, he's very deliberate. He's slow. He has a small range. He only uses two roost sites. As turkey hunters, hopefully you can relate to that. You know, well, that's, he's not a risk taker, right? He's a shy guy. And I think it's not a leap of faith. If you just listen to those two scenarios, which scenario do you think would be more likely to be shot? And it would be the risk taker, right?
Yeah, sure. Yep.
And that's what, so I've got some work being done now from one of my graduate students that is, and I'll preface this, it's not published. This is ongoing work. So the fact that it's not published should be important. And what that means is, we've gone through the process of conducting this research, asking the question, conducting the research, analyzing the data, and writing it. But it has not been
been peer reviewed yet.
It's not peer reviewed. And that's a critical distinction. If it isn't peer reviewed and published, then it needs to be discussed in the context that it's not. We as human beings are terrible about this. We like to skip steps 1 through 5 and get to 6, right? And in my world, it's important to understand that you have to get through step 6, which is publishing the work, before you're going to discuss it as such. So I'm prefacing this by simply saying we're at the last step now, but we're not through it. That being said, the work does show that these toms, when we stick them into these bins, in other words, if we assign these behaviors or these movements as being risky and these movements as being shy, these riskier toms are more likely to be shot. And what's interesting is, in some places, some of those same movement behaviors are impactful to the bird's survival, but then on the next study site, it's not. And it suggests that, one, there's a lot of complexity in this, but two, the probability that a bird is going to interact with us and die is likely being influenced by, you know, landscape differences and road densities and all these things that would influence our probability of interacting with a tom in the spring. But it's an interesting mental exercise. And here's why I think it is. One, we're seeing that there's a lot of variation across toms, right? But we're also seeing that there are certain traits that are being selected by hunters. And what I mean by that being selected, that they're influencing the bird's mortality, right? We're more likely to kill birds that are displaying certain traits, certain movements in this case. Not something like, well, he's following the hens and doing this very specific behavior, and that caused him to be shot. I'm talking general things. He moves more. He's got a larger range, movement type things. So we're seeing that these behavior, these traits exist, and we're seeing that there's selection for certain traits. The next question becomes, are these traits heritable? Like, Are these things that could be passed down through generations? Are there behaviors that are going to be, you know, transitional from one generation to the next? And I had this conversation with a student the other day, and it got spirited, because this is really interesting to me. Because other research on other species is showing that some of these traits that a certain sex exhibits, a certain behavior, they are heritable. And so through time, would we see changes in how this bird behaves? Would we see changes in how they react to us and how they respond to, say, pressure or hunting activity? And that's a really interesting scenario to me that causes me to want to get up in the morning and think through it, because mm-hmm. it's, to me, it's thought provoking that through time, could we see, or are we in the midst of seeing that how this bird we cherish is behaving relative to us is changing, is in the process of changing?
What you're describing almost reminds me of things that we have been talking about at the duck camp for years, like with imprinting. You know, you allow ducks to come into an area. You don't harass them. More and more come back every year, that kind of thing. I'm sure there's some science behind that, but I'm not 100% sure. And then another thing is a parallel, maybe like back when those spinning wing decoys came out in the duck world, mm-hmm. it seems like you could put one of those things out and they would just land on top of it. And then after years of shooting every one of them that did that. So I'm trying to come up with a scenario in my mind that would match what you're talking about.
I've got one up right with you.
And now it's more difficult to hunt and harvest a duck coming into those decoys. You got to have wind, and you got to have more of them, and that kind of thing.
We just talked about one, though. And I think even maybe closer is, and again, this is just theory, but I believe it strongly, the deer in the Southeast, we just got through talking about it, it's different. And so for whatever, 40, 50, 80 years or something down here where we had populations and a lot of the country didn't, we shot, what did we shoot? Everything with antlers visible above hairline. So years and years and years of all this hunting pressure and all the ways we did hunt them and all too, and killing everything, every, even, you know, year old buck that walked that we could shoot. It changed. There's no way that nature doesn't adapt to that. And next thing you know, we're breeding more and more and more nocturnal bucks.
Specific to our research, I just want to be clear. So the naysayers that are going to listen to this, that for us to demonstrate that what we're talking about occurs in turkeys, we have to do step three, which is not just see that there's lots of variation and not just see that we're selecting for certain types of behaviors when we kill birds, but to see that that it's heritable.
Right.
And we haven't gotten to step three. So just, I just want to, you know, be clear.
Actually,
with that.
Likewise, so, I'm stating opinion. Like I told you before, research.
I think it's a really interesting exercise because, and I got to thinking about this recently, and don't we as turkey hunters in almost every aspect ask the tom to change his behavior?
Like, yes. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing I learned was, you know, the hens always go to the gobblers and you're trying to get the gobbler to come.
We try to call him away from a stationary object. We try to get him to come closer to something that he can't see and he thinks he should. We try to get him to do these things that, you know, we've known for decades. It's supposed to be something different than that. And we problem solve, right? So I was reading a passage from Wayne Bailey the other day, and the passage said, you know what, as we evolve as turkey hunters, and he wrote this back in the 1990s, this passage, and he said, basically to paraphrase, it might get harder to hunt turkeys. They might get pretty slick because, you know, we're human beings and we try to figure out ways to, you know, to do things. And as turkey, as the hunting technology increases and there are more turkey hunters, that it may get more difficult to hunt turkeys. And I think that's interesting because those words were published in the early 2000s. Now, what's happened since the early 2000s in the turkey hunting world? It's been remarkable. So we as society, we're problem solvers. All right. So, damn it, the bird spooked. It must have been this camouflage pattern. You guys.
That's never fixed. The case. Come on.
Yeah, you fixed that. I couldn't get him to come that last little bit. Let's design a tool to fix that. I'm not able to hide because I can't say stay still. Let's fix that. So we're problem solvers, right? I mean, that's what we do. So I think if Wayne were still alive, he would have to chuckle that he wrote this and he underestimated our abilities as human beings to problem solve. So these, you know, instead of, yeah, I think sometimes very likely are getting extremely difficult to hunt. And if by chance these traits end up being heritable, it's something I think about when I start thinking about, God willing, I'm here 30 years from now to be able to turkey hunt. What's it going to look like? What how's the bird behavior going to change? If it is at all.
Boy, I sure
think it's interesting to think about.
I don't need them to get any tougher. That's for sure. No.
You know, and again, just opinion, but you know what washes back over that and helps so much to me? A great hatch. There's nothing like having a big hatch, especially in subsequent years. That kind of washes back down some of that evolution that makes things like that happen, to me at least. All kind of things, even like getting your you know, it's going to be out of whack because we hunt them anyway, the gobbler to hen ratio and whatnot. But all of a sudden, if you just do the math, it's just science and math. You do the math on like whatever, you got three gobblers and 20 hens and it's way out of whack. But if you keep on pumping out 50-50 or even more than 50-50 to the gobbler side, subsequent years, the next thing you know, that ratio is not so bad out of whack and the behavior's different and the health is different. I mean, it's nothing like, for everything going on, a great hatch. It didn't. That's why my t-shirt will say, maybe they bury me in it, happiness is a great hatch.
So it sounds to me like you're teeing up some things that you're studying, like some of these, I don't know, crutches, if you will, to make sealing the deal possibly a little bit easier. Is that what you're studying, is different scenarios?
I'd say that, right now, the group of students that I have are, they're stronger than any group of students I've ever had intellectually. Mm-hmm. And I have people that are working with me that are really interested in going well deeper into how turkeys function as a species than what I have done previously in my career. Their interests are in things like these personalities and how it may influence their survival. They're interested in things like, how are these flocks structured? Who are these flock members? How are they related to one another? Where did they come from? How many toms produced these flocks in our population? Who are our breeders? How many are there? I mean, these are the types of questions that that my folks are looking at. And I mean, we're doing a ton of work on habitat issues and identifying places that these birds go so that we can, you know, for instance, we were talking about these breeding sites. These sites are permanent from year to year. You know this. All of you know this. These birds go back to the same breeding places every single year. Well, if we can identify through technology how to predict with good certainty where they are, then we can tell an agency where they are. We can tell private landowners where they're likely to be. And in so doing, perhaps we can incentivize or otherwise encourage people to conserve and sustain parts of the landscape that quote unquote look like that. To your point, Dudley, the folks that are doing work with me now, and not just students, but other colleagues, we're trying to get deeper into the bird than we've ever had the ability to do. And part of that is because some of the people that are interested in turkeys now, young people, are coming from different backgrounds to labs like mine. And they bring a different expertise and they bring a different perspective. And that's always refreshing to me, because if you got really smart, talented young people thinking about turkeys, then that's a positive scenario.
You give us such a gift, Doc, because, and I'm not saying putting you up on a pedestal, you're the only one, but you give us such a gift because you're never, ever scared of the truth. In fact, you are so brave to, even when it rubs the public wrong, to be sure and remind us all, it's like we need to keep learning the truth. And there's so many truths, as you pointed out earlier, people want to go to six. They want to, okay, there's a couple things. Okay, that's the cure-all. It's like we talk about trapping. Just trap the predators and everything will be rosy. Well, there's hundreds of issues going on with turkeys. And for you to keep bringing us those truths and doing it in your way and with the discipline and the credibility of rock solid research is such a gift for us, because how can even our governments make great decisions if they don't have the truth, you know?
Yeah. And he's making us think.
Yes.
On our own.
Yes. Because as you have taught us, just like the great hatch that I crave and we all crave, it is complex. Well, guess what? The whole ecology, biology, survival of a wild turkey is so complex. And, you know, just like what you're talking about, it's no magic bullet, even if you, you know, vet a certain fact out of it. But when you combine it with all these other things we've learned through the work of researchers, then it becomes something you can make good decisions about more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
it's kind of like two things you're taking. I think about taking prescriptions from the doctor. He has me on antibiotic this week. But, you know, this one doesn't bother me. This one doesn't bother me. But then when you have two or three things going on, they interact, you might get something different. So when you have all these facts interacting, and especially the factors that are affecting the nest success, I mean, you know, you've got to manage and consider all of it. And what you're working on now is fascinating. You know, one question I did have – when you're back to talking about the different almost personality types they have, I guess, is that a fair thing to call it? Are you coming up with, is it like human psychology where there's the six groups that exhibit these type things, or is it like you're just establishing a personality per bird as you encounter them?
No, well, and that's a good question. I'm glad you asked me that. So what we're doing is we're this is an important caveat. We're assigning these birds a personality, right? I mean, we're saying that doing this is more risky, moving more, for instance. So what we're doing is we're, instead of assigning every bird, you know, personality 1 through 500, we're sticking 200 into this bin, if you will. And the other 300 act kind of the same. So we're putting them in this other bin, understanding that within each one of those bins, there's a ton of variation, you know, across the individual birds. And obviously we're doing that out of, it's more simplistic, right? From an analytical standpoint, you're trying to take this really complex question and boil it down to where you can make an inference, right? And in this case, the inference being that birds that tend to move more or less have lower survival, or birds that, and one interesting, and I didn't mention this, but this is really interesting to me, is it looks like from a personality standpoint, whether a hunter is going to kill you or not can differ across the landscape, but whether you're going to be killed by a natural predator appears to be very, very consistent across the landscape.
Wow.
And that is, you know, these toms that tend to hang out near open areas and they're visible, and, you know, those are the, based on, again, this data set that isn't yet through the publication process, it suggests that those toms are more likely to be taken by natural predators. And that got me the other day thinking about this. Okay. So I don't think many that listen to this podcast would argue that we have a fairly predator rich environment, right? I mean, we have a lot of predators out there. Mm-hmm. In just the last few decades, have you seen any change in the percentage of birds that you see in open areas.
100%, I have.
Yeah.
I mean, we all talk about it, and of course, we blame it on not having as many turkeys, but, you know, or blaming it on, you know, whatever people, poachers stop on the side of the road and shoot them. But
sure, for
maybe a good 10 years, 8 or 10 years, Dudley, I'd say we all are talking about, man, you just used to ride around in the spring and see one puffed up in field here, field there, all around. And it is greatly diminished, no question about it. Now, what does that infer? I don't know. We'll leave that to you.
Is that
but it's what definitely it's definitely a thing.
I think a lot of us, anecdotally, I'll add, are assuming that it may be because of populations of raptors and things like eagles are expanding.
Who knows? I'll say this. I've noticed for sure also, anecdotally, but I've for sure more and more and more, our very best duck hunts are where there is overhead cover, whether it's flooded timber. It actually doesn't have to be flooded timber. It could be flooded brushy stuff. But we're having more and more, especially mallards. I think that's off subject of turkeys. But I feel like it's the same type of thing. I see mallards more and more and more. They either go feed at night, which is really numbing or whatever. But they also, they go to an open field with some good food, and they're in there and they're out. They don't like to sit around on that open water. And it's got to be, I mean, I don't know. I'm just anecdotal. But it's got to be.
And I got to thinking the other day, too, about gobbling. And again, this is just a mental exercise going down, you know, the speculative route. But, okay, so if we are seeing these selective pressures on this bird. And we are seeing that certain behaviors may, you know, increase their mortality rate. Well, if these selective pressures are at play, could it influence their gobbling activity? And I think back to all these scenarios that we see where, you know, and I've talked about this before, that we know that that gobbling activity decreases as hunting pressure increases. We know that it's logical, and I think we all see it. But you also see situations where, and we do this now a lot, where we see this now, where a lot of the gobbling activity is in the tree. It's not on, there's very little on the ground. And if these traits that turkeys exhibit are heritable, are we in the process of seeing how that this bird gobbles differently or displays differently, or are we in the process of seeing something that's been at play for decades now, as the popularity of this sport has increased, as, you know, like our pioneers warned us that, you know, we're going to become better at what we're doing here as hunters, and the bird is going to change. And when I go back and read these things, I think how prescient was that person that, you know, they were hunting turkeys on a landscape where, for instance, restoration was occurring, and they already were seeing with their own eyes the bird was changing in front of them, and they were speculating, like we're talking now, that okay, well, could it continue to do that change? Could things continue to change? And it's interesting to me because I'm intellectually curious. You know, these types of questions resonate with me, and particularly since Toxie's point, I think, is so valid. We're turkey hunters are cerebral. We think a lot, you know, and this bird gets in your mentality, right? You start thinking about the bird and why he's doing what he's doing. And as an aside, we're doing the same kind of personality research with hens, and we see distinct personalities with hens as well, that there are some hens that are more risky and they do things differently than other hens. And as an aside, the more riskier hens tend to be the more productive hens, in our populations, the ones that tend to sit, to incubate more, to take fewer breaks from their nest, to not use as much space, to really kind of hunker down during the nesting season. So there are other personalities at work in this bird that have fitness consequences, just like we've seen with the toms being survival, you know, and the hens it's survival and whether they hatch a clutch.
So through the years, I've experienced, and it's just one occasionally, but it'll be, and I've always called them a tree hopping turkey. Mm-hmm. They would fly from.
You know, I have a bunch, but it's always been where I know for a fact, and it's been on most of my own places with people I'm familiar with. It's always been where I know there was a high concentration of predators. Like we used to, when we first got Shimola, that's back in the 90s, our family place, it was not uncommon at all to have a gobbling turkey fly in tree to tree, gobbling, be sitting up there 50 yards or more away, gobbling, watching everything, didn't see a hen fly off. But we were infested with coyotes, bobcats too. And I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that was what that was about, because they hadn't even been hunting that hard before we bought it. Couldn't have been hunting pressure much.
So would that be a personality, Mike, or would that just be something they a learned behavior?
I suspect that's a learned behavior, because I've seen the same thing. I've seen it several times when I screwed up and I realized the bird. I can think of four times this has happened to me. One of those times I felt pretty sure the bird had seen me and knew that there was danger there. The other three times, I don't think the bird knew there was danger there. I think he had gotten skeptical enough to cause him to change where and how he was going to fly down. And his original path would have put him near me. And so he moved and altered where he was going to fly down. And that's what I think. I'm just mm-hmm. speculating based sure. on what he did. And then I'm thinking to myself, okay, in all those cases I got there, and when it got enough light for me to really pin down where he was at, I realized I wasn't where I wanted to be. I should have been back over there. So,
well, look, I get a lot of my exercise jumping to conclusions around here.
mm-hmm. So, yeah. Good. As long as you say it's your opinion, it's okay.
So this research that y'all are doing that you've said multiple times hasn't been peer reviewed yet. So is that kind of leading us down a road that we might be shooting the easier turkeys, so to speak, and the ones that are not getting killed that have these evil characteristics that we kind of started off talking about in the beginning?
These evil birds? Yeah.
I mean, that's not going to change. I mean, I didn't mean to jump in and not let him answer it. Sorry. But
No.
It's not going to change. I mean, if you're out hunting and you call up a turkey, you're going to shoot the turkey. I mean, we're not going to stop shooting that turkey. Right. So, honestly, the big caveat seems like to me, Doc, and that's what I'd love for you to comment on, is like augment that with the hunting pressure and the over-harvest. And then you've got an issue. If we're not over harvesting and over pressuring, I mean, we have maybe on all our clubs, we start to have little sanctuary areas, but we're addressing that and we have good hatches. It doesn't seem like it would be near the issue as what we're dealing with today, with a little bit of over harvest and definitely too much pressure. And our hatches have been less in the last 10 or 12 years.
Where my mind goes is, first, Bobby, to your question, if we end up seeing, and this is a big if we do end up seeing that any of these traits are heritable, right? And you're seeing that instead of having, let's just say we have a population of toms, and instead of having a bunch of risk takers, a bunch of kind of those in the middle, and a bunch of super shy toms that are really hard. You know, they're skeptical of every leaf on the forest floor. If these traits that cause these, you know, probability of being harvested are heritable, then what you're going to see through time, how long this takes, I don't know, is that they're going to end up being disproportionately more that are in the center and shy, and you're going to see fewer individuals that are quote unquote risk takers, because you're going to select against that trait, right? So if these are heritable traits, then at some point we will see that. We don't have the data to get there yet.
I need that.
What really what really interests me, and boy, I'll go down the road. I'll go ahead and jump in there and understand people will get mad, but I think about some of the things like the workarounds we have as hunters, like, the bird's vision. I couldn't, there's no good place to set up right here. And I need to be here to kill this bird. Well, I'll put a blind up, right? We're problem solvers. So we've got this issue comes up and we fix it with this. Or I couldn't get the bird to close and I'm having trouble getting the bird to close. And if I'm going to go back to Wayne Bailey, cause I've spent a lot of time learning about Wayne recently for reasons untold, but, Wayne used to lament his calling. He said that, you know, I'm not a really good caller, but I think like a turkey and I can figure out where they want to be and I'll put myself there. And if I do, I don't have to be that good of a caller. But okay. So I'm not a good caller and I'm having trouble getting birds to close. Well, maybe a decoy would help or, you know, whatever the scenario is, I'm unable to be successful, on these morning hunts because I'm having trouble getting where the birds want to be. I'll hunt longer. I'll use these tools to my advantage. And those are the things that I think about because I just wonder with all the things we have at our disposal, and I'm not casting stones. I use a lot of these same tools myself. I use the best camouflage I can. I use the best calls I can. If I am around a person that calls better than me, like if I'm with Toxie or I'm with Billy Yargis, I'm putting my call in my pocket. I'm going to listen to what they're telling me to do. You know, I'm using what I can, but it begs a question to me. If these tools prompt a bird that otherwise would not be risky to suddenly be risky, and that risk causes mortality, that's interesting to me because that would kind of undermine this personality idea, right? Mm-hmm. It would kind of throw it into disarray because in that way, it really, in some cases, doesn't matter what the bird has been doing, how he's been behaving. It matters more what he interacts with then, like on that hunt or during that week or whatever the case is. That's interesting to me because, you know, I hunt a lot like you guys do, and I see birds behave certain ways. And since I mentioned decoys, I'll just throw it out there. Yeah. We've all seen individual birds behave differently around decoys. We've seen some birds that throw caution to the wind and they come running. And we see some birds that look at it and go, there is no way I'm walking over there. I'm heading the opposite direction and everything in between. And I've always wondered for the birds that have such a visceral reaction to that, say in this case, that decoy, did he do that before? Like, is that something he's done before? Or is that something he literally just did that's the first time he saw a decoy and he did that? Y'all seen the same things I've seen. That is really interesting to me because I have to wonder if that's the first time he did that and he lived, is he going to behave the same way next time? I don't know.
Yeah. And I've always just assumed they had a bad experience at some point in time around a decoy. And they said, well, I'm not trusting that ever again.
Yeah. But it's like no more decoys than actually used, at least in our group or crowd or properties, much that I know of. It seems like it might affect them quicker than every bird having seen it. It's almost strange how fast things affect behavior that I don't see how they all witnessed it to change it. I don't know. It's almost, I know it's not true, but I mean, deer and turkeys both, I feel like they go back and talk to each other. I know they can pick up on each other where they're feeding.
Hey, buddy, don't walk over there.
Yeah. They do that about feeding. I mean, they can tell because Dr. Woods taught us a long time ago, deer constantly sniffing each other's mouth. I saw it since I was a kid. Well, guess what? They want to know what you've been eating, where you been, you know? You got found some fresh greens. Oh, the neighbor's feeding corn. That's great.
Let's go. You know, they can pick up that, but this kind of stuff, it's amazing how it kind of rolls through the population. Too, with
calls.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about this on podcasts before about their individual calls, like their vocalizations. Do they recognize each other?
Yes.
That type of thing. You know, and I have to wonder, to your point, Toxie, you know, if a turkey makes a mistake,
he's dead.
There's only two options. He either survives it or he doesn't. And if he makes a mistake, unless I'm misunderstanding crippling rates across the country,
right,
when that gun goes off, most of the time he dies. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. There's sometimes he survives.
Yeah. I've missed many of them.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Let's not even get started with that crap. Y'all, don't even go there, Bobby. Don't even. I'll fix that. Look, oh, yeah.
I've been wanting to slowly bring that up at some point, but we'll wait. Go ahead.
You might as well. I fixed it. I got a new gun. I've got a sight that I can see. And
that's just like those new golf clubs will solve everything. Mm-hmm. No, it
really has. It's helping me, though, because my vision is failing because I spend too much time in front of a computer. And so anyway, yeah. Bobby, you go ahead and throw that story out there whenever you want. But yeah, these are the types of mental exercises I have. And I think I enjoy them because, you know, we all have these conversations amongst ourselves and
we do
bring these topics
up. If we sit at a turkey camp, these things go on. And again, it'll get to be a heated debate when opinion becomes fact with all of us. But we do. We sit. We talk. We have from the first days I can remember being in camp when I was Dudley Wood too, listening to the older men. They had all these theories that were just it was endless about every facet of the wild.
Oh turkey. Yeah, fire it, ants. Yes, you know, all of those conversations. Exactly. Yeah.
What I was going to say was what to demonstrate the complexity of what you're studying is that there would be no doubt that. You can't just have like risk takers and not risk takers, because you've already told us that there are things that happen that will make a shy non-risk taker become a risk taker. So he's always wanted to breed, but he's never been in the right pecking order. So maybe who's been keeping him shy and scared to breed is gone. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, over time, his hormones are up enough. Well, guess what? He's by himself. He's a risk taker, you know, and maybe that's a turkey that wouldn't have come to a call before, but now.
And we've actually, that's a good point. We've actually seen this, and I haven't talked about this on this podcast before, but this is not work in my lab, but it is published. This is work using our data, but analyzed from a different group of researchers. And what they found very clearly was that if you go into a group of toms and remove one, the probability that the other toms survive decreases. And as you increase the numbers that you remove from a group, so let's just say you have three, you take one, the survival of the other two goes down.
Wow.
You take two, the survival of the third one goes down even more. And I think, again, Mike's speculating, I think part of that is probably wrapped up in the personality, if you will. It forces the bird to change their strategy. They don't have the safety in numbers. They don't have this stability in their environment that they had. It doesn't matter to me whether of those three birds, you know, one of them was almost assuredly dominant of the other two, but it doesn't matter. The point, we don't have any way of knowing that in our data, and these researchers didn't either. They just found that as you started, no pun intended, you started pecking these birds out of these groups, that the survival of the remaining group members started to decline. And that does, to me, kind of suggest that it forces those other birds to change kind of how they've been, you know, the strategies they've used. And to Toxie's point, maybe it does cause them to take more risk. Maybe, you know, it puts them on the move, for instance. Maybe it causes them to move faster or whatever
right,
the case
like
may be.
Maybe the wary personality dies, you know, and so they don't have that guy looking out for them anymore.
Just like ducks, the more ducks there are in a group, especially in hunting open places, the harder they're going to be to get to
commit to your decoys and stuff. In the same way, I forever just marveled at a bunch of turkeys out in the open. Even in the woods, when there's a bigger group especially, it's like somebody has always got their head up watching. And there's one, you know, when you got to like scratch a mosquito or something's driving you crazy and you just can't move your pin down. And there's a hen. She's got her head up. It's like, oh, my gosh, is she a statue just sitting there? And simultaneously, where her starting to drop her head 1 to 10 yards away, rises up. Mm-hmm. And now that one's watching while they feed. It's really cool. And I know that's got to be a survival thing that they've learned over the years. The
strength is in numbers.
I mean, that's group dynamics. Yeah, I mean, that's a social order there that, you know, flocks matter. That's why
the more they have, the more somebody's going to smell them. Yeah. Danger if it's happening.
I tell you something that's starting to concern me a little bit. I'm watching David, and David has scribbled a lot of notes.
His brain is turning.
He's an encyclopedia for this topic.
I'm seeing David's eyes. I'm watching his eyes, and he is deep in thought. He that notepad has caught the wrath in the past hour.
Yeah, this is something I thought about earlier when you were talking about the shortcuts and things like that. And of course, I know you're familiar with Leopold and his work, but he back in the 30s in Sand County Almanac, I believe it was, talked about his concern of learned skill and gadgetry and things that would circumvent that whole maturation processes of learning the quarry, learning the research, the resource, things like that. And I guess some of my concern is now that some of the tools that are so effective in certain situations and on certain turkeys, like you said, with personalities, really don't require a ton of knowledge about the bird, about, you know, some of the situations we find ourselves in. And is that something that from your chair or maybe even from department chairs and these people that are decision makers, is that something that concerns, because obviously we want people in the sport. We want more foot soldiers for the cause. But if there's things that cause such a high adoption rate and have such a high success rate, at least anecdotally speaking, is that something that could attrite the resource faster than certain other skills and tactics that we use? And I don't know if you were kind of hedging around that, but at least that's something I thought of when you were mentioning that.
Yeah, no. I mean, and I think there's two themes to what you just brought up. One is that, you know, there, and that's part of why this conversation started about posting on social media. And part of the reason that I did that and still do that is I think it's critical that all turkey hunters understand the biology of this bird, that they're stewards of the bird itself, not just hunting it. And I'm not the first to say that. My predecessors, you know, men and women that paved the path for me to sit here and talk to you have been saying that for decades, that we all need to be true students of the wild turkey. We need to understand how they function. We need to understand their morphology, their behavior, everything about them. And in so doing, you are a hunter, but you're also a steward of the bird as a species. And I do think that gets lost through time. And that's part of why I think it's important that people like me that have information to share do it in a way where people can relate to it and they can gain information and keep learning, because I learn every day something about the bird I didn't know. And I hope when people read content, they're, you know, assuming it's content that's vetted and it should be there, that they learn from it. To your other part of your point, I'm concerned about that notion as well, that with all of the shortcuts that we have, And again, we were warned years ago that we would develop these shortcuts. It's what we do as a society, right? As man and womankind, we problem solve. I am concerned that in some ways, some of these, and I'll just say all of the collective kind of tools and techniques we have through time may allow us to change how this bird is functioning on the landscape. And, you know, again, that's based on, at least thus far, you know, we don't have a ton of data on it, but
I mean, don't you think it already has? I don't see how it could help, but not.
And that's kind of what we've talked about has. I mean,
surely it has.
If you just kind of step back and look at it, we've probably already seen many of these changes. Mm-hmm. And I have to wonder, well, are these going to become more pronounced? Are, you know, where does the technology end, if you will? You know, I don't know the answer to that. But yeah, David, it does concern me, because at the end of the day, from a science perspective, what we really need to be able to tell agencies is fundamental pieces of information, like, you know, how many birds are out there, which we don't well understand. How many birds are being killed, and what percentage of the population is that, and what are you producing, and when you have things that could alter these things that we're measuring and that we don't understand. And for instance, you know, two things, like I brought up blinds and decoys. We don't really understand what effect either of those have on harvest rate. In other words, the percentage of toms are being killed. If I had a data point and I said harvest rate is higher now because of this tool than it was, then I could answer a question definitively, but I don't have those data, and neither does anyone else. So as we continue to evolve these tools, understand that we're working with a lot of uncertainty and in the dark to some degree, because we don't know the impact that we're having on these things that agencies track through time, or they hope they can track. And that does cause me some concern, because I like knowing, right? Mm-hmm. I want the information. I want to be able to answer the questions, and understanding, you know, these types of questions are tough. These are tough questions to answer.
Yeah. On that, Mike, can the understanding of the biology of the bird versus a hard data set and hard study guide some of these decisions, though? Understanding of social hierarchy, how they interact territorially, things like that. I mean, are those things that can factor into those decision-making processes, or is it something that you want to try to prove this tactic right here had this effect on the population?
I think understanding the bird, David, in a lot of cases would allow all of us to make our own decisions and to inform ourselves as to what we're seeing with our own eyes, whether it be managing our property and failing to get the response that we're hoping, or making a change and seeing a response and not fully understanding why or what's at play. For instance, if we all educated ourselves about what brood habitat is and isn't, then we could go and critically evaluate our own properties, mm-hmm. and go, oh, there's a problem. You know, if we all understood growth patterns of poults, for instance, and what they have to eat and what it looks like. And to you, so to your point, yes, I think just being educated about what the bird is and how they function and what their annual cycle involves would allow us to make better decisions about many things we do, whether it's our hunting practices, our land management practices, all of, you know, everything that goes into managing the landscape for this bird would be improved with knowledge.
Absolutely. That's a great segue. When I was making notes about what I wanted to say in response to that, is that because I get to speak on behalf of everything Mossy Oak if I want to, and I just want to be sure and say that we do not sit in judgment. We do not. Now, there may be someone that works here, someone we're affiliated with that, that passes judgment on things. We do not sit in judgment of people, but what we do seek to do is enlighten everybody, you know, and you just said it. They make their own decision. That's the magic. Let them make their own decisions. You know, sleep in the bed you make, and that's good. We don't need to be getting all personal about something we don't agree with. However, we do not need to hide from the truth either, and we need to be open-minded and listen to it. So what I love about the things we're doing today here, it's a little different, is that irregardless of harvest techniques, whether I agree with you or not, or maybe science has proven it's improper, it may be vetted somewhere else than us, what we do see happening, which is very important, I think most important actually, is somebody somewhere taking responsibility for every little piece of earth around here, whether the state people are taking care of the state places and the federal people, the federal places, but individual landowners, individual club holders. I mean, you do, you're a model of how you should handle yourself as a club, as a group, as a family, of long-term ambitions for the place. Of course, you have all that knowledge that a lot of people don't have either. But my point in saying that is just everybody taking responsibility for something and making it a, not just work, but a joy to go do it. That's what we're trying to get out there from all of this. And, you know, the best way to do it is what you do for us, Doc, is give us the truth. Because it's kind of a good analogy. One time when I was trying to learn to hit a golf ball better, and I give it credit, Bill said it, and he said, I was like, where are you going? Well, I'm going to the practice range. He said, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to get some tips from BJ. And so, well, I'm going to go practice too. He said, what difference does it make if you don't even know what to practice? And I say, he made a pretty good point there. So we need the truth. We need you to keep giving us the truth, but we need more than even that, probably everybody more and more to start taking responsibility for some piece of the earth that they love and the critters that they love. And it's happening. It's the coolest thing to see and the feedback from people. And it's created a new age of wildlife management. No question, with leadership from you and your counterparts and the way, you know, just like this podcast, we can disseminate so much more information than ever. You talked about Turkey Tuesday. You talk about the Wild Turkey Lab. And there's so many tools at our fingertips now, you know.
You know, Mike, he says all that. And I agree with him. I'm real proud of him. He's a great guy. But he judges me pretty hard.
Well, that's the difference. I said we don't judge the rest of the world. We judge each other harshly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's inside the walls.
So
well said.
Yeah, it was. Mike, and you've been a big part of helping to open people's eyes to what they can do on their properties for turkeys. It's really amazing. You know, guys are now they're doing stuff that, David, you see it all the time, that we're trapping, we're doing things that we typically weren't trappers, and now we're learning how to trap.
Mm-hmm. David, when did you start the Wild Turkey Report? 12 years ago?
2012 or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, David had been convicted of enlightening people and giving them a forum, like predecessor to even us doing a lot of stuff, and Doc doing stuff too.
But you know,
my
even
hats
with
off to him, you know.
Even with me, at the early days, it was about hunting the bird. And I personally went through a year in 2015 where 2/3 of the mornings I went, I didn't hear a turkey.
Yeah, that was the disastrous year.
And it was a gut punch for me on, hey, we've got in. So these conversations started happening. And
hey, nothing stimulates asking questions like that happened to what y'all described. Mm-hmm. And what really set us on fire back then, because our place and our families are right next to each other all through life with them, with David's family. And but the other thing he didn't mention is like 2012, the hatches had set up. That was supposed to be a banner year for two-year-olds from what we had hatched. And nothing happened. And, of course, I think it was more widespread than just our little part of the world there. But that really made you take a second look at what in the world is happening to our bird. No explanation from anybody to this day on what happened, David, still. I mean, we, you know, it's like, oh, they had a dolph. That's the only thing you could was. Surely we'd find some sign of that. But who knows? It was crazy. We never explained what happened. It's just like
you have die-offs of animals. You know, when we have hemorrhagic disease outbreaks, you find carcasses.
Yes.
When you have avian influenza or cholera outbreaks, waterfowl, you find thousands of carcasses.
Feathers everywhere if something catches a turkey.
There's been no such ever recorded incident with turkeys where there's been mass, you know, discovery of carcasses. So it's more sinister than that.
I don't know.
That's a good word, sinister.
It was sinister. Let me tell you something. Two-thirds of your morning's offspring, you don't even hear one gobbling. That's what I call sinister.
Yeah. So, look, I think it's, at this point, it's. I want to make sure we make a point that we talk about, you know, all that we're doing for the turkeys and how much we enjoy hunting. But, guys, right here at the beginning of the season, everybody needs to remember to slow down and be careful.
Yeah.
Turkey hunting, we're in the woods with guns, and you got your hunting buddy there.
Yes.
You know, on public ground, there could be somebody. You just got to be careful. And last year, I heard a couple of instances where guys were crawling with a fan in front of them.
Got shot.
So, not passing any judgment on that technique, but that's a very dangerous scenario.
It is the biggest thing. Is any you can preach all you want on a podcast or wherever, but keeping your presence of mind. I mean, I know certain people that I hunt with, and at the point of attack, something happened. They are so over the top excited like a little kid. They don't have a presence of mind. They could really make a bad mistake. So it's like I try to tell myself, because I can get that way. I love it so much. It's so exhilarating, especially under certain, you know, scenarios where whatever, one's drumming and you can't locate him and boom, there he is. Those exciting things happen. To try to tell myself, keep your presence of mind, take a breath and enjoy it. Don't be so scared he's going to get away or whatever, it gets you so anxious. You know, I've always been, I got into the camera. I was so just absolutely the greatest anxiety in my life was spooking one, you know. What? Just take a breath. Keep your presence of mind and you'll enjoy it more. Probably miss less of them too. I need to do that for sure. I joined the club. I don't know if it was the bug jumped off your back to me, but there's a side story, but there's one place we call it. I call it the Bermuda Triangle. And I hadn't missed three turkeys total other than there in 10 years. But I missed three successive ones in that same area.
Oh, wow.
And then I'd missed one, so it's four in the last 10 years in the same spot. So I call it the Bermuda Triangle. I literally let the monkey jump on my back.
Was that where we took Mike last year?
No, it was not.
Well, you were a true conservationist.
That day really affected me. I'm telling you.
No, I know it did. I knew it did.
That upset me so bad. I mean, I was so crushed that, you know, you miss a bird, you miss a bird. But in that situation, I was like, this is, and you know, that would have been my Royal Slam.
Wow. So the lesson learned from that, and he did, he shot a bird and he was on my place and there was another one or two with him. And like a good citizen will do, and a really good hunter will do that cares about his place. Boom, he just flattened one he shot. Just boom. And I guess it's like deer. If they're totally motionless, be careful. But instead of jumping up there and running out there and someone was sitting with him up there in front of me, I was calling from behind him. But he didn't. He sat there and didn't get up because he didn't want to bust the other turkeys. They were still putting and didn't know what happened. And he was going to let them walk off for the next thing you know. After it had been like a minute or more.
Yeah.
Because I heard boom and I was so excited. And then a minute later, I hear boom again. I said, uh-oh, that's not good. And sure enough, the turkey jumped up. He was wounded bad, but he jumped up and gathered himself. And if he'd have just gone on out there and gotten on him like we all do, nothing would have happened. But that's a good lesson. It's like, you know, if you got to choose between disturbing them or doing the ethical thing, do the ethical thing and go get your turkey, you know.
Yeah, I've thought back, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but I've thought back so many times. I was so deflated. I was like, you should have thrown your respect to the wind and just said, you know, to heck with these birds. I'm getting up and running over there, which I don't typically do anyway. I mean, if I can see the bird, I just kind of sit tight.
There, yeah.
Look, the bird was flopping. I could see it.
And I could see him. I could see him laying there. And I should have, in hindsight, I should have known. When it got quiet and I couldn't see his back anymore, that he had flattened out on the ground. I've kicked myself. Mike, you know so much about turkeys.
You were trying to be a good guest. You were being worried about what I would think about you running out there. And I mean, now I've learned. It's like, go. You know what? If it spooks him, it spooks him. Go get your
turkey. It won't happen again. I can tell you because, man, that would have been. I had this goal.
Wow.
I didn't know that because I was going to Mexico. I thought if I'm ever going to do a Royal Slam, it's going to be this year. and I didn't kill an Eastern.
of all turkeys.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Wow.
And that was the one. Oh, that was the one.
Ooh, that was a great morning, too. Woo!
It was. But, you know.
That's okay.
I learned something. I learned something valuable.
Let's turn the page here just a little bit. Mike, why don't you lean back and put your thinking cap on?
Oh, gosh. I think I know what's coming.
I want to show to
He is embarrassed, even the best biologists in the country. And he says it like, oh, here's just a layup. Don't worry so much.
Look, this isn't on biology of anything. Okay. This is on a movie that I happen to know
worse,
that,
you know?
Mike loves. We have a mutual love of a movie.
Oh, my gosh.
And so let's key up this trivia, though, Rich.
You got to be kidding me.
Today's trivia is brought to us by Sheffield Financial. Because your finances are not trivial. We're playing for Anthony 909. Left a review. Love the content you all provide. I always learn something listening to you guys, and I've listened to every episode. And keep up the great work. So he has already won. So
yeah,
he has automatically won a Spartan Lumen trail camera.
So since you were here before, I kind of scalded him a little bit about it. I said, we shouldn't put the pressure on our guests to have to answer the question for our listener to get the prize. So when we bring their name up, they get the prize automatically. You're playing for you to get a prize. How about that?
Okay, Bobby? Good.
So is that better now?
Yeah, that's right. You scalded and scolded us.
Yep.
So and others.
Yep. So that Spartan camera, that's a pretty good prize.
That's pretty slick now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Those are really nice.
All right. So now, does Mike win?
So now Mike's playing for a Gamekeeper Podcast t-shirt.
All right.
Yay.
Yeah.
All right. You don't seem too excited as we thought.
Bobby will sign it
for you. Well, you kind of started out talking about one of those super duper cameras. I mean, he was looking for something like that.
I was thinking, man, I'm about to get a Spartan camera. Well,
should we switch
him up?
Should we switch it to Anthony to get the t-shirt and Mike get the Spartan?
Yes, we can get the Spartan.
I don't know. Anthony may.
No, we won't do that.
We'll get Mike a tank top.
We can do that.
Yeah, there you go.
Wife beater, that'll do it.
This is, I'm going to read some dialogue, and you're going to finish it for me. I know I've got little 8 snippets, and I know that I can set a scenario, and you can either fill in the blank or finish the scenario.
Boy, you're out there on a limb by yourself, Bobby.
Now, this will be fun. Okay. Guys. So y'all hang in here.
Mark this time code, Richie.
Let me put my glasses on.
Is this an icebreaker 98 minutes into the podcast?
Okay. Yeah. All right. Richie.
Touché, Rich.
You woke up. Hey, Richie. There you go. All right. So we all love Buford T. Justice. And the T stands for turkey, as my understanding is. Could be Turkey Tuesday there, Mike. All right. So this is the words of Buford T. Justice. First thing I'm going to do when I get home is blank.
Punch your mama in the mouth.
All right. One.
All right. And number 2, there is no way, blank.
No way that you could come from my loins.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Wow.
All right. So number 3, he's standing next to his car. He looks at his son and he says, put the blank in the car, Junior.
Put the evidence in the car.
All right, there we go. Got that one right.
Wow.
So Junior is standing outside at a gas station. And Buford T. Justice cracks the door and hollers, you want something? And Junior hollers back,
hush puppies, Dad.
So they screech to a stop on a dirt road. Junior gets up on the hood and he says, it's a blank, Daddy. Can we stay?
It's a baseball game, or is it a football game?
Football
one or the other.
Game, football game.
Football game, Daddy. Can we stay and watch? You stay and watch the game. I'm going back.
That's right. So then another one. He says, they're stopped on the side of the road. I think they're in Mississippi. And there's a bunch of cars going by. And he says, Daddy, he had a lot of friends. To which Buford T. Justice says,
I'm not going to say exactly what he says.
Bobby tried to get you.
But if he said, if they had a cremated him.
That's right.
I could have been kicking that Mr. Bandit's, you know what, around the moon by now.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. Yeah. And then so the last one I'm going to ask you is, he's at the bar. He has ordered his sandwich, and he looks at
none of this one even.
The bandit looks at him, and he says, "Somebody chasing you, Sheriff?" And Buford says,
"Nobody chasing me, boy."
That's right. He got them all right.
So oh, my goodness.
That just shows he's so
giddy.
Diverse.
Bobby is giddy right now. I've never seen him so giddy.
I'm going to give you a true story before we end. So in 1997, I started as the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Wildlife Management, which is quite an honor. So for 2 years, I handled every peer-reviewed article that was published in the Journal of Wildlife Management. And each issue, you're asked as an editor to write an editorial. And my first editorial, which as an aside, a colleague, you've had him on, Craig Harper of University of Tennessee, actually laughed with me one day about this because he said, it takes a special person to write an editorial on a scientific article that mentions smoking a bandit, but I did it. my first editorial was called An Attention Getter. And the reason is because we had the journal had changed its cover and its, you know, its look, and it was designed to, you know, right, attract attention. And I used that quote from Smoking the Bandit, where he on the side of the road, he says, "Hold up on that car wash, gentlemen." You know, when he pulls up and he kicks the one kid in the butt and he goes, "That was an attention getter." And so that's what I used as my lead in for this editorial was Smoking the Bandit. It was funny. It was comical how many people caught it too, that got it, that was like, I know what he's getting at there. And Craig was one of those. That was me putting the best movie of all time into what was supposed to be a serious editorial.
Yeah, you did a great job with those quotes there, Mike.
Toxie, what's your favorite movie?
Oh,
of all time,
no question about it.
What?
Just don't name my dog after that character. My number one is Forrest Gump, and my number two is Lonesome Dove.
David,
Forrest Gump's number one for me.
Stand By Me. What's yours, Bobby?
Smoking a Bandit.
Yeah, I like Smoking. I also like The Big Lebowski for some reason. Yeah. I like that. Bobby.
Richie,
there we go. That's a good choice, sir. You know, True Grit always sticks out.
That's a good one. All right, Doc, what's next? You got to name one more besides Smokey.
Believe it or not, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
That's a classic.
I love that movie. Yeah.
So it's funny. If we talk about movies, we'd probably do a whole podcast on, but it reminded me exactly of Daniel and Neil, and actually David too, and Joe Dirt. They can quote every single line out of Joe Dirt. And when we watch it again, it hadn't been in years now, but we would watch it subsequently, like whatever, during the holidays. And they literally would never stop mouthing the entire movie from start to finish. Yep. They could quote the whole thing.
I think one of the newer movies, not newer now, it's older now, but one that if I see it on the TV, I have to watch it is The Hangover.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I laugh like a child.
Yep.
As if I've never seen it, because that group put on a performance. It's just, it's timeless. That movie is hilarious so many wrong ways.
And we're way over time, but I got to mention to you, and you hadn't seen it yet, but I'm stepping out talking about it. But in just a couple of weeks, it'll be to the public. We just kind of did our first movie, pretty much. It is a documentary movie, but The Colonel and the Fox. And it is, we watched it last week as a company. We had rented out a theater and had a premiere. A couple of places that's going to happen. We're going to release it to the public in a couple of weeks. It is. I honestly, I know that's me bragging and my pride's talking. It's the best thing we have ever done. It might be the best thing ever in our industry. It's incredible. I cannot wait for you to see it because it will rock you to your core emotionally in what you've done with your life. So I can't wait for you to see it. I just hope when you get it, don't just sit there and watch it on your phone. You know, swipe it up to a TV screen or something.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, can't wait.
We'll get you one before it gets out.
Let your wife watch it with you. You could tell her you're going to watch Smokey and the Bandit Part 4, and that'll get her excited.
That would turn her off right there. She'd be out.
But it has a great history of the wild turkey and its conservation alongside of their lives. And so you'll love it. I can't wait for you to see it.
It's fantastic. Mike, we're going to send you a podcast shirt, and we're going to send your wife a podcast shirt too. So she'll
deserves one. This is God's honest truth. I've gotten a text from her recently telling me that I'd like you to come look at whatever this bug is when you're done with your podcast.
Isn't it refreshing how they don't care what you might be in the throes of? If there's a bug or a weed emerged in the flower bed or the dogs did something they're not supposed to. I think
there's something beautiful about that. It is. It's just not really caring what you've got going on. I've got a bug here. I want you to take a look at it.
Life. You know?
I love it.
David, thank you for being here.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. Did anybody learn anything today?
Everything.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know where to start.
Yeah. Y'all tune into Turkey Tuesdays from at Wild Turkey Doc. That's some good stuff. We appreciate all you're doing, Doc, and keep up good work. If you get in this part of the world, we'd love to take you hunting again.
And let us know what kind of bug that was.
Yeah, I'll probably have to Google it. I'm not an entomologist, but I appreciate you having me as always. It's good talking to you guys.
Absolutely.
You're like family, and if I can get over there and get another hall pass to put my back against the tree with y'all, I'd love to do it.
Come on.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, anytime. We're open. We don't have a lot of traffic coming through, so we stay pretty open.
We love to have you.
So you just let me know what works.
All right, guys. We'll look forward to seeing you. Richie, thank you. We're going to miss you next week. And looking around the room, we've gone on for a while.
What time is it, Bobby? It's about 3?
Yeah,
30? They don't fly up until about 7, the time change. We got time to go try to roost one.
That's right. Well, why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley. Get us out of here, Richie.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.